just going to recommend to any young comics. It's, you know, it's not politically correct to say, but it's a good idea when you start doing comedy to just find someone who has a job who you can live off of.
Welcome to the Michaela Peterson podcast. This is episode 119. Clearly my studio still isn't set up, although this is an iPad and looks pretty good. Long story short, I'm allergic to Tennessee. Nashville was amazing. I just moved to Franklin, but I forgot I'm basically a bubble person and there's greenery everywhere. And so I'm allergic to everything. I may be moving to a desert. Maybe I'll live in a yurt, probably be allergic to the dust. Anyway, I don't know if you can tell, my face is puffy. I have other allergy symptoms, but I can't do it. Can't do Tennessee, too many allergies. One day I'll have a studio again, sometime soon, in some city, somewhere. In this episode, I spoke with Yanis Pappas, a comedian from New York City. Yanis is an American stand-up comedian, actor, and podcast host from Brooklyn, New York. He co-hosted an award-winning series and a sports comedy show, in addition to participating in festivals around the world and live shows. I liked him a lot. This was a good episode. We spoke about a number of topics, including him getting shot, recovering, getting through PTSD. We spoke about the transgender mixed martial arts fighter who pretty brutally won an MMA fight, fighting under the name Lady Feral, with a t-shirt on that said end trans genocide while beating up a woman. Anyway, the conversation gets weird. It was fun. Please hit subscribe and hit like if you like it, or don't. Either way, I hope you enjoy the episode. This episode is brought to you by Orate. I'm allergic to most things, including most metals. Orate, though, it's a fine jewelry brand made by women for women. They have super diverse pieces from classic to statement. I wear their minimalist gold rings that I absolutely love. Super cute, fine jewelry that I can wear, very high quality. I keep them on in the shower, when I'm playing with Scarlett, and even when I'm cooking, because I don't have to worry about their pieces with their lifetime warranty. Not only does Orate sell these high-quality jewelry pieces at an affordable rate, but they give the customer a chance to shop with a conscience because their gemstones and diamonds are never mined and conflict-free. If you guys need a piece of jewelry or want some of these minimalist rings that are super cute, check them out at oratenewyork.com/Michaela and use promo code Michaela to get 20% off your first Orate purchase. That's 20% off with no minimum spend. They rarely have discounts as high as 20% off, so I'd check them out now if I were you. Other brands usually offer 10 to 15% off, so this is the best offer out there. You do have to learn how to spell my name, though. So that's oratenewyork.com/Michaela, spelled A-U-R-A-T-E, newyork.com, promo code Michaela, M-I-K-H-A-I-L-A. Thanks, Dad. He named me that. Check them out for 20% off, and you can tag us on Instagram, me and Orate on Instagram, if you decide to purchase a piece. Yanis Pappas, welcome to my podcast.
Welcome, Michaela Peterson, to me being a guest on your podcast. It's good to be here.
I'm excited. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah.
I've seen your specials. I'm a fan.
Thank you.
So this should be fun.
I'm a fan of you. I've been watching the clips from your podcast. You've had some friends of mine on, and I'm happy to be here. This is amazing. And here means, you know, in my house. We're doing this virtually. Yeah. But you know what? I embrace the future.
I'm not embracing the future, but I'm making do with what we have for the moment. Are you in New York?
I'm in New York, and we're both two COVID survivors. So it's good to speak to another COVID survivor. I saw you caught COVID in Russia. I caught it on the Flagrant 2 podcast. And so we have something in common. Not only we're North American, but we also are COVID survivors, which is good.
I've had COVID. I've had COVID twice.
I know. I saw that. COVID really likes you.
Well, it does really like me.
Canadians are just more welcoming generally. So maybe that's had something to do with it.
I think it was me pretending COVID doesn't exist really that made it happen so many times.
Ah, you listen to the Joe Rogan podcast.
I do.
I do indeed. Okay.
I kid.
Before we get started, for anybody who isn't familiar with your work, can you give a brief background about who you are and what it is you do?
I'm a trans man who is living my dream as me. No, I'm a Greek American kid from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a stand-up comic. I got a podcast called Long Days with Giannis Pappas. Formerly, I had a podcast called History Hyenas. Chris DiStefano was a lot of fun. And I'm just a wild kid who's currently on 10 milligrams I don't even remember what it is because they call me Yanni Biden. So I remember I'm on 10 milligrams of something. Lexapro. That's what it is.
Oh, man. I took Lexapro. It did not agree with me.
No?
No, not at all. It made me really volatile. And I do not need to be more volatile.
Really? Are you volatile?
Very, very. Yeah. I did my dad's personality test. I scored 98th percentile on volatility.
Wow. At least you didn't do the Robert Hare test and come up psychopath. That's the worst one, right? As far as personality traits.
I would say psychopath's probably not great.
Yeah. Well, it's not great for other people, but for the psychopath,
that's true.
You live unencumbered by guilt. And that's true freedom. Now, if you think about who the freest people on the planet are, it's probably psychopaths because they don't have any feelings. So they're totally free of any commitments or emotions. That's a free life.
That is a free life.
Yeah,
that is a free life. I've actually considered that before, not having the guilt or that voice in your head that tells you when you're doing things wrong. Yeah, that actually doesn't sound half bad for you.
Can I ask you a question? If like they figure out a way to do brain surgery and take out that emotion, which they'll probably be able to do at some point, would you have it removed? Would you become a psychopath? I'm curious.
You know what? Because of the amount of guilt that I'm experiencing now, no, I wouldn't be able to go through with it.
Right.
So my current personality would stop that from happening.
I would just be too curious. I'd have to do it. And then I just couldn't wait to look at myself in the mirror to just see the death in my eyes. And I would just look at myself and go, cool. And then I'd go out in the world and destroy. Have some fun. Okay. I think they have the real fun.
I think they probably do.
Yeah.
Well, no, I would say maybe not. Maybe you don't get the positives associated with it. Maybe that's why you have to do more extreme behaviors in order to experience joy properly.
Yeah, but I mean, what's more lit, that or just like sitting around thinking of weighing consequences? I think skydiving sounds a lot more lit. I mean, we can ask your pops. He probably knows because he's probably sat down with a few, but they just have a lit time. I mean, yeah, occasionally they'll bite off a titty, but you know, that's not all of them. That's just like a few of them who go awry, you know? Just don't get
that's
in the,
true.
Yeah, if somebody asks you to get in the backseat of a beagle and they're pretending to have an arm injury, just don't get in, ladies. You may lose a titty.
Wise words.
That's all you really need to know to have a safe life. Stay away from someone who's injured asking you to help them put something in their car.
Oh man, I'd fall for that.
You'd fall for the 10 Bundy 1-2?
Oh, instantly, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, oh no, an injury.
He was.
I've been there, I can help.
But what would it be because of his looks or would it be because you just felt bad?
Oh, well, looks would definitely come into play.
Yeah, he was a pretty handsome devil, to be honest with you. For sure. I might have helped him out too, to be honest.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Are you able to do shows in New York right now?
I am able to do shows. I'm a little concerned. I have a newborn, 11 months old. So I'm a little concerned, not really in New York, but like I canceled my Texas and Florida dates because I'm a cuck. And I care about my daughter, goddamn it. So yeah, I'm just, you know, until there's like more data about like how it affects kids and stuff like that. But it's looking pretty good. I read some study. It was a small study of like only a few kids, but they were like in the ICU with COVID and no long-term effects a year later. So that's good. So I'll probably go down to Florida and Texas, or as they like to call it, the real America, and do shows soon. But I did postpone those shows, but I am now getting back out on the road. And New York is like, yeah, New York's wide open. You can do shows now. You have to show your passport though. There's somebody at the door who goes, let me see your papers. Says he, you're going to Switzerland. I don't think so, Mr. Greenberg. Hands up, Dr. George.
That, so they're actually doing that in New York.
Yeah,
they have, they're about to do that in Ontario. Yeah. I think at the end of September.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I talked to, I talked to like doctors, like this one doctor I talked to, who's like a, he's brilliant. He's a surgeon and he's a Republican, which is why I trust him in this, you know, because like, if anyone's going to be conspiratorial, it's usually that side with this. And he's like, yeah, man, it, you know, it's a dangerous bug. And, you know, he's like for the mandates because people aren't getting the vaccine. Cause he's like, that's the only thing that's going to end this pandemic. So it's like, but then I listen to people who turn COVID into content and they're saying something different. So I don't know who to trust, people not on the internet or people on the internet.
Nobody. Absolutely nobody.
Yeah.
I didn't trust anyone, but I've had COVID twice. And the second time was pretty rough. My best friend, it's COVID's all over Toronto right now. My best friend's kid, he's 6 months old. He just caught it. So both his parents were vaccinated, but he's little, so he wasn't vaccinated. And the dad, this is interesting, and it's just anecdotal, but the dad was vaccinated with Pfizer and he got quite ill. Mom with Moderna, no symptoms. And then little Levi got sick, but he was sick for like 2 days with a tiny bit of a fever. They gave him Tylenol and he's better now. And now he's probably immune for a while. So
yeah,
that's my anecdotal study on vaccines.
Well, I guess the main thing is that they're all okay. No big deal for any of them.
Yeah.
That's the point. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the
They're
point.
All fine. I was just in Austin checking it out as I was considering moving. I don't want to be in Canada anymore. I'm tired of Canada.
Do you have your,
so,
yeah, do you have your, what is it? I know you guys got to pay like 10 grand to get your,
the O-1?
The O-1.
It's in the works.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's coming.
Good.
But I can be there for 6 months hanging out before that comes in. So that'll come in. But I was looking at Austin because I have a whole bunch of friends moving to Austin and I was there last month and I really didn't like it.
Yeah. I don't like it either. I was considering a move for a second, you know, because after I did Rogan, I was, and New York was shut.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, maybe I'll move down here. He's like, I'm opening a club, man. And it's going to be great. It's going to be a comedy mecca. And then I spent some time there and, you know, I got, you know, homeless people were throwing bricks at me. And I was like, wow, I'm kidding. But I mean, there's the homeless are like, it's like a zombie apocalypse down there in downtown. And I was like, I don't know if I could do this, man. I'm from New York. I'm used to a really nice city. New Yorkers are arrogant. Shocked. We're arrogant. We are.
For good reason though, or is that just because everyone else there is?
Good reason, I think. I mean, let's be honest.
But you're from New York, so you'd say that.
I'm biased, yeah. But I mean, like, there's a reason why everyone wants to come here, at least pre-COVID. I mean, you know, it's every other city kind of looks like New York, the casino in Vegas to us. We go there and we're like, wow, look at these are your skylines. And we like pat them on the head. They're like, this is so cute. Nice little job, Kansas City. It's New York is a universe crammed into one. And then you go to another city and you do the downtown like in a day and you're like, that's it. And yeah, so it's tough. But if you like barbecue food and only barbecue food, Austin's your spot.
Now I'm going to go to Nashville.
Nashville's a good one.
I've made my decision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nashville's a good one. That's a beautiful town.
I know. I love it. I'm currently wearing cowboy boots.
Do you like country music? My wife loved, like, she's just like a big fan of country music.
I like old country. I don't know about the new, I don't know.
Right.
Maybe one day I will when I'm there and it's everywhere constantly.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got one of the biggest country singers ever, right? Shania Twain. Shania.
This is true.
Yeah. You guys can really, you blend in with us, you know, you guys are like, you really sneaky. Canadians are sneaky. You'll meet one and I'll be like, hey, you're American. And then as soon as, that's why I force everyone I suspect is Canadian. And I always set, I suspect someone's Canadian because you guys have like a molested glow, like a nice thing. You got like that, I'm in a cult look in your eyes. And so if I see that in the eyes, I suspect, is this person Canadian? And you can't tell until you hit an A or an about. So I usually try to frame a question where I know an about's going to come in. And then I'm like, gotcha. Gotcha, you Canuck.
Ah, I don't think I sound Canadian.
You don't. That's why
I say about.
Yeah, you guys blend right in. You're like CIA agents.
Convenient.
You're spies for Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, no, hell no. Hell no. Okay. I want some background information on you. Like,
let's do it.
When did you get started? How soon did you make comedy a full-time thing?
I had like a very, very jagged journey. It wasn't a straight line like anything in my life. So 2 steps forward, 10 steps back. You know, I started like in 2000 doing stand-up, then 2001 in May. And I was off to like an auspicious start. Like I started hitting the road. I was doing colleges. I was having fun. The GL1s just came out. So me and my buddy started filming. And we were doing that before anybody on the internet. And then I got shot in 2001 in a robbery, attempted robbery at a nightclub that I was working at. You know, I was just trying to make cash doing comedy. And then...
Were you doing security?
No, I was working... I mean... If I did security, I mean, rob that club. I was working like, he created like some bullshit jobs for me because he was a friend of mine. He was the promoter and his parties were like really like, you know, it was all like drug dealers and, you know, people would, I did the cash register. So people would come in. I just remember dudes just pulling out wads of money and, you know, it was that type of party. The place I got shot at actually, another infamous thing happened where there was this famous director. He might have been Canadian. I don't remember if I'm thinking right, but he was walking home one night in Soho and outside of this club I used to work at, and this can be Googled and people can read about it. It's a crazy story. Somebody shot somebody in their car and then the guy tried to drive away while he was shot and he died behind the wheel. And this director, like whose career was just taking off, was just walking home and the guy who was dead in his car got shot, hit him and killed him randomly. And that was the club I was working at. So that I got shot, you know, it was kind of the milieu of that spot. It was a dangerous spot. Oh. Yeah. So
jeez,
that was that.
How long did it take you to recover from that?
It was quick. I mean, what happened was, you know, some guy like tried to rob us and I got shot point blank range, like in the car. And and it was like in my upper inner thigh. And I stayed overnight in the hospital, but it missed all the main, there's like a main artery there. It didn't hit. I was lucky. And, you know, I had a very beautiful doctor digging in my asshole to find if it was compromised in any way. That was embarrassing. Like when I got to the emergency room, you know, she just like to check if
how to make it worse.
Yeah. It's just the whole
like on top of it.
Yeah. And you know what I learned though? I don't know if I've ever talked about this. I learned how women must feel. And I mean this, I learned how women must feel when like they're assaulted or something like that, because cops they're very insensitive. Like when they come to get the story, like when a crime happens, I remember like, because I was shot, the cops just assumed, because usually people who get shot are involved in some sort of shady stuff. So they were just like making up stuff, trying to catch me in a lie. They were like, he said, because they caught the guy. They were like, he said this was part of, so he was, the kid was like, I don't know, Armenian or so. He was like, this was some sort of Greek Armenian beef or something. I was like, no. He was like, he said, if you would have said, If I would have said what he said, you would have done the same thing. So like, what'd you say to him? I was like, I don't know who the kid is. This is, you know, and they just didn't believe me. And they were making jokes with the bedpan. They were like, look, Captain, he can put it on his head. He's got a nice hat. And I'm sitting there just like shot. And so when they try to get the story, it's like they're very insensitive. So I could just imagine being a woman going in there, telling their story. And they're like, yeah, but like, you know. Did you know the guy? What were you wearing? You know, did it? I could just kind of picture that insensitivity. Maybe now things have changed because of Charlie's Angels and the Me Too movement. I call it Charlie's Angels, where they're just fucking girls activate like, and get everybody.
I feel like things have probably changed. That sounds miserable.
It was.
Especially, wow.
Yeah. Because my feeling...
How long...
Yeah, sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was just saying my feelings were, yeah, I was like in a vulnerable position and like, you know, you're just sitting there and...
How old were you?
I was 23.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty young for that to happen.
Yeah. And so I was just like, the cops were like being skeptical of my story. And I was like, dude, but I get it.
Can I just heal and go home?
Can I just can you just hand me a lollipop and make me feel better? Call my mommy and tell her to come.
Yeah. Jeez. So how long did it take? How much of a hiatus did you take after that?
So it's interesting. So I just kind of like, they let me go the next day. And then like, I couldn't really sit on a toilet or anything for a while because it was so sore. They left the bullet in because it was too deep in. So they were just like, we're just going to leave it in. And then eventually your body will push it out. Like, you know, I guess your body.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
What? I didn't know that was a thing that they actually did.
Yeah.
That seems like the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, it does seem like the wrong thing to do. Like, hey, get this out of me. But apparently your body will slowly reject a foreign object and push it out, like your body knows. And that's kind of what happened. Like it slowly made its way to the surface where you could like feel it. And then I got it removed like two years later. So I
wow.
Yeah, I was home and then I had an SNL audition. I just started comedy and I had an SNL audition like that week. So I did it. I did it like 4 days after getting shot. And it was I didn't know the psychological effects of this thing, like PTSD. So I went on stage and like, I bombed. I like completely bombed. And like, I was like kind of having these physical reactions, like, you know, shaking and hyperventilating. And I didn't know what they were. I wasn't connecting the two. And that went on for like a while, like a year. And I didn't know, I couldn't connect the two, that I had PTSD. Cause then I started like, I'd get on the train and I just start hyperventilating and having a panic attack. I get off and I go, what is going on? Like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I guess I went from this state of like this benign denial of never thinking something like that could happen to like my brain going to the opposite extreme, going like, wow, this could happen at any time. And I was just, my subconscious was like freaking out. So I went to therapy and I got over it. But, you know, anxiety has been a part of my life ever since. Thanks for opening that door, whoever the kid was who shot me.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I quit comedy for a little while.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's not that surprising.
Yeah.
The first time, so I was quite sick when I was young. And when I got better, I started having... This has never happened to me, but I started having panic attacks when I went into hospitals and just from the association of that and surgery. And so the first time I went into a hospital and it there wasn't like a mental component exactly, but I went to a hospital and I was like, I had that like physical thing happening. I was like, what is happening? Oh, that's like panic just from like my body doing that. It was very strange.
Did you have an advantage because of your dad? Did he let you know early what it was or?
So I told him, I was like, I can't go into hospitals. I don't know what to do. Like if I go into a hospital or even anything, I was pregnant at the time when that really started happening. So even going to the midwife, just because it was peripherally associated with the hospital, I'd get this panicky feeling again. And I was like, Dad, what do I do? Do I need to do like exposure therapy and like walk around hospitals for a while and then like go in them slowly? And he was like, no, given what happened to you, that's totally a reasonable response. I was like, okay, well, guess I'll just figure this out on my own. Thanks, Dad.
It's amazing how sensitive we are, like as humans. We're just like these emotional, like a psychopath don't feel anxiety at all. They don't feel fear. That's why it's so free to be one. But it's just amazing, like nothing's happening. We're not in danger at all. And we freak out like we do because we got these big brains and we're pussies.
Yeah. Well, also some of these things you can kind of logic out. You're like, well, I shouldn't have had that kind of response, but something like having surgery or what happened to you, it's pretty reasonable for your body to be like, nope, make sure that never happens again. That seems like a pretty reasonable response.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. I mean, you would figure your mind would just be like, you're okay though. Your mind would, but I guess that's how strong the subconscious is. Cause I didn't know what it was until a therapist started pointing out. I remember like the city, you know, cause the city pays for your, you know, there's some victim fund where like you're victim of a crime, you go to the hospital, it's paid for by the city. And then they offer you like counseling. And I was like, why do I need counseling? Yeah. I was like, I'm fine. I feel fine. And then a year later, I mean, I was dealing with these panic attacks for like a full year. And whenever I'd go on stage, I started freaking out. I'd be sweating and hyperventilating. And so I just kind of quit. And then I did something a little more relaxing, which was social work with 9/11 victims. And then I started having more panic attack and I took on their anxiety. It's brutal, brutal time. It was a dark time.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound good. Just relax. Don't go on stage in front of a bunch of people. Deal with trauma victims.
Yeah.
You needed to be like in a cottage somewhere at a beach, breathing for a while, resetting your nervous system.
Yeah. I did social work then for about 5 years. And they just threw me in there at the beginning. And I remember like one of my first clients was he was a pastry chef at Windows on the World. And they like, he lost all his friends. He was off duty that day. And the first day we were like talking, I was like, because I was a caseworker. He just started crying to me in the room we were in. And it was my first like day. And I was like, wow, like I was so detached. Like it forced me to grow up faster than I should have probably. And I think it was just too much. And so it was just overwhelming emotionally. And I just went into a dark place. And I think it's called countertransference or something, where like you take on the anxiety of your clients. Like you know, if you're in social work or you do any type of healthcare, I can't remember the term for it, but I remember I would have anxiety going to sleep because I was like helping people get mortgage rental assistance, victims compensation fund. We had something. So I worked with people who lost their husbands, lost their jobs, lost their livelihood, lost their whatever family members, the breadwinners. And then there was something called the unmet needs table, where you would present the client's case to all these charities, like a group of charities. And then based on what you were asking for, they decide what to give. And I remember going to sleep worried about like, I got to get this person's rent paid or mortgage paid. So I kind of took on their anxiety. It was a dark time.
That is an insane job.
Yeah. It was wild.
That sounds like you might be. So that personality test, I'm obsessed with this personality test, this Understand Myself that my dad's made. I've been using it since before it was on the internet, giving it to like potential boyfriends, judging them harshly. I'm dead serious about that too. But it sounds like you probably scored high on compassion. You can say counter whatever, but people who don't score as high usually are a little bit more detached. So you might have felt detached, but like if you were taking on people's, if you cared that much, you might have scored higher on compassion.
Yeah.
Even though you're a comedian.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I've been in comedy a long time. I'll tell you, there's two types of personalities I've noticed in comedy, either extreme empaths, like very sensitive, or like, or like dictator level sociopaths, nothing in between.
That seems accurate.
Yeah, that's what I've noticed. If you think about it, it's a job that's very similar to a dictator. You stand in front of the crowd, you woo them, you get them to follow you. You know, you lie, make up stories, and charisma, lots of charisma. You know, we have a lot in common with asocial types. So, yeah.
Maybe it's a different way of reading the crowd. Like maybe people who are less agreeable or less compassionate do something more charismatic and do a different type of read than people who are empathetic or empaths. And then maybe they can feel the crowd more. Not sure how that would work.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder. That's why I'd love to get into the mind as someone who's seeking to control more than to connect, because they both work.
Yeah.
They both work very well. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, I've met some.
Okay, so, sorry, no, go ahead. You've met some?
No, I was just going to say I met some comics who you meet them off stage and then you see them on stage and you're like, oh, that's not you at all. And it's like, it's all a method. It's all thought out and premeditated. It's marketing. You know, it's what Madison Avenue's been doing for us, you know, smoker, you know.
Like pure, like acting, right?
Pure, like, sociopathy. Yeah, like kind of like that's not the person at all. You know, look at Bill Cosby. I mean, for example, you know, I mean, evil people always pretend to be the opposite of what they are. Nobody comes into a room and announces, it's like, if you hide behind, I'm clean, I'm wholesome. Look what the Catholic Church does. You know, it's like, call me father, make sure you confess to me. So I have things to blackmail you with if you try to, you know, if you find out what I've been doing. I mean, you know, it's we're holy, we're good. And it's like, they've just been mass raping kids. It's like, evil people, it's always the wolf in sheep's clothing. That's how evil operates. They never walk in and announce they're evil or else they'd be caught.
Yeah, true. That's not good marketing.
No, it's not.
I'm the evil sociopath. Trust me. Yeah. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. That's what makes them so fun.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So you did get back into comedy. So how did that start?
It started slow. Like I was doing social work. At that point, I was working for an ad hoc agency for 9/11 relief called LDRNY. And that was over two and a half years I did that. So around 2005, I was getting unemployment and that ran out. And then I started working with mentally ill and formerly homeless people in an SRO, which is a New York thing. And then I slowly started doing a show once a week with Donnell Rawlings, who was really the guy who got me back into stand-up. And I always give him credit for that. And he was, if you don't know who he is, he was like Ashy Larry on the Chappelle Show. And now he tours with Chappelle all the time. And that was right when Chappelle's Show was coming on the air. And then it hit big. And so he took me on the road with him and Burr and Charlie Murphy. And I would sell his posters and do 5 minutes. And so that he got me back into it. He kind of pulled me into it, telling me I was funny. And he gave me the opportunity to perform in one of his rooms that he had in Manhattan once a week. So I started doing comedy once a week again. And then slowly I met more people, started doing more shows, and I got back into it that way. So that was about 2006. And so that's when I really started again and started for real, you know, started going after it. And then I went full time in 2008. I quit and just lived off my girlfriend at the time. So.
Okay, so since 2008, so that's quite a while.
Yeah. I recommend.
Okay, so how do you. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to recommend to any young comics. It's, you know, it's not politically correct to say, but it's a good idea when you start doing comedy to just find someone who has a job who you can live off of. It worked.
I'm going to clip that.
Yeah.
When you do sets, do you come up with a whole storyline of kind of what you're going to say and you have jokes that are in your head, or is it really on the fly? I'm always curious how comics can go on stage and tell, you know, story after story and remember what to say next.
I think there's two types of comics. I mean, there's variation between those two types, but it's really the comics who write their jokes beforehand. They write them down and then go perform them. And then there's comics who write while they're on stage, who take a premise. And that's what I am. I'm a comic who writes on stage. So I take a premise, something that in my head I think is funny, or something I say to someone who I think is funny. And then I just take it on stage and play with it. And then little by little, you craft it that way, like a sculptor. You just kind of change a word here. And your goal is just really democracy. It's like you can't get everybody, but you're looking for the most to appeal to the most people, get the biggest laughs in that area. So you craft it around that. That's what you have. And you can really only do that on stage. So I think even the people who write beforehand, once they test it, they'll go back and rewrite it and tweak. And that's what comics do. You just tweak it to make it the most appealing to the most amount of people.
Well, it's no wonder you have some anxiety. That sounds anxiety provoking.
It is very anxiety. It's, you know, it's the biggest fear people have for a reason, you know, it's public speaking, especially if you think about we're expected. I think some egghead timed it out, like about every 8 seconds, you're expected a laugh in order to do good. So speaking publicly is nerve wracking enough, but when you're expected to get a laugh, like every 8 seconds at minimum, it takes a while. we all are like turtles. I mean, comics have like, and that's what you build up over years is just a thick skin. So, you know, whenever I read my YouTube comments and someone says like, my eyes are too close together, like, I just love it. I love, you know, I love being made fun of. I mean, you could say anything to me. I mean, we publicly are rejected. It's the only art form where you practice in public and the audience tells you in real time, you get rejected in real time and you can hear it and you can see it in their face. You know, other artists go in their room and they practice. And then they present, you know, somewhat of a finished product. We are always on display.
That's a very good point. I didn't think I figured, if you're singing or something, it's a song that you've recorded in studio and then you've practiced it so many times that almost everything is perfect. And so that's completely different than on the fly trying to make people laugh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm that latter type of comic where I wing it a lot. And so things will come to me in the moment. Necessity is the mother of invention. So it's a real tightrope walk. I guess I prefer that. And you go out there, you try something and, you know, it works or it doesn't. And then you craft it based on that, the next show and the next show and the next show. And now with podcasting, I feel like comedy's changing too. And you're going to see certain comics like who can do a podcast. Like you see, you know, Tim do, you know, I have a similar style to Tim where it's like, we just rant for like an hour. And you sometimes you watch a Tim Dillon episode and you'll be like, that was as good as any crafted special I've seen. So yeah. It's like, because of the internet and because of how fast things moves now and how many things have already been done, maybe that's changing. Maybe like stand-up will become more like riffing in the moment, current events, things like that. Because I mean, we're kind of like running out of shit, you know, it's like everything's been done.
Oh, but the world is changing so quickly. There's so much new content.
That's true. But what's relevant today, you'd be surprised. It used to be you can have an hour for like two years and then record it and it would still feel kind of relevant. Now things move so fast that you're kind of like, you have a bit and you're like, or you go and you look at Twitter and you're like, there's 20 people doing tweets about that premise. And, you know, it's like, so it is a little bit more of a challenge in that way. You know what I mean? Because you're like, the world moves so fast and there's so many people tweeting and so many people consider themselves funny. And there's more than just stand-ups now. So we used to have a monopoly on funny that we don't have anymore.
That is very true. That's very true. Even with podcasting, if you want to hop on something, you have to find, like for me, if I'm trying to comment on something, I have to find someone, record it. I have Eric, his team editing it, and then release it right away and learn about it. Yeah, you're right. That is tricky. And things do age quickly. It's like some controversy like 2 months ago. It's like, oh no, people already freaked out and rioted and protested and now they're over it and on to the next thing. And that's done now.
Yeah. That's why I sometimes suspect that we may be coming to the end because, you know, when you drop an apple from wherever, you know, up high, the farther it falls, the quicker it falls. And so I feel like we're about to hit that ground because things are moving real quick. They've sped up. So I hope it's not over. I got a kid, but it's a little scary. You know, there's this push to get off the planet. It's like, you know, these elites, you're like, what do they know? What do they know? Like, you know, they're just like, they're trying to skip town.
I'm trying to skip town. I don't know anything. I'm just like, I'm not comfortable in Toronto. Maybe Nashville will be nice and comfortable for a while before that angst gets there.
Yeah. I mean, don't you feel like the news is a little apocalyptic now? It's like reading the Bible every morning. It's like fire here, flood here, riots here. You're like, what's going on, man? It's weird. And I almost feel like these elites like Bezos and they're like on the lifeboats of the Titanic. They've like taken a few of the lifeboats and they're just like rowing away, you know, and we're
like, we saw this coming a long time ago.
Yeah.
We have lifeboats for myself, all our friends, some yachts. See you guys.
Yeah.
I see that. I see that for sure. We'll see. Maybe things will improve. Maybe things are either going to, like, I don't think they're going to stay like this. they're either going to improve, like the economy is going to open up, like we'll either get used to COVID or it'll get less bad, or things are going to get way worse. I don't see like a, I don't see us hovering around this weird level we're at now for very long. People are too angsty.
I've thought that for a while, you know, especially with like how zany the left has gotten. In some ways, how zany the right has got. I'm like, this can't last forever. Maybe this is just people, you know, I think it's people struggling to adapt to something as powerful as the internet. We've never had anything like this where information, there's so much information coming at you this fast, and such a pure democratic medium where everyone has a voice, and it's people are just adapting to the power of it. But every time I'm like, it's coming to an end, I read the news and it's like, you know, trans woman who was a man a year ago just choked out a woman in MMA. I'm like, this is getting wild.
This is getting wild. I saw that. Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah, it is wild. You know, and you know what's funny? Nobody ever really talks about the point. Like, it's like, how come you never hear any controversy about trans men trying to compete with men? If there's no advantage to being a biological man, why aren't there all these trans men protesting to get into men's sports? Because guess what? Men would welcome it. If there is a trans man, if Elliot Page can cover Odell Beckham Jr. in the open field, God bless him. You know, some little 5'6" trans man who was born a biological woman, who's just, you know, they always got that voice like, hey, I'm a trans man. How you doing? My name's Buck Angel. If those men can compete with male pro athletes, God bless them. But obviously the point is they can't. They can't, because when you're a man, you have an advantage physically that a trans man could never catch up to at the pro level.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. Like, I see news articles like that where it's like, that woman MMA fighter, she got like fairly hurt. And it was like, duh. Like, if we can't recognize that that's going to happen as a society, we're not very smart.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. People want to be compassionate. They want to understand, but like.
But it's not compassionate to let somebody get beaten.
No, it's not. And especially when that, I think he picked the, you know, she, I'm sorry. I'm on notice. I put myself on notice. I'm sorry. I misgendered her. She was like a he a year ago. I like took up MMA a year ago from what I read.
Oh,
and then competed like in a pro MMA fight against women. You're like, what are we doing? And they test the, I guess they test the levels. I mean, I'm no scientist, but it's like.
Yeah, but it's not all about, I mean, that's silly too. It feels like there's no scientist behind that, because you can't just test a level of a hormone and be like, okay, it's even now.
Right.
Like, yeah, what about all the muscle growth
right.
and the bone structure and the shoulder width? And like, what about everything else that has to do with it instead of this one like marker that can be like kind of artificially suppressed?
Right. You're right. It's like they cherry picked the one thing. And if you see a before picture of that girl, that trans woman who just choked out that woman in that MMA fight in Portland, of course, or Oregon, he was buff. I mean, he was like a big dude. So it's funny, like the before and after picture, he was a big guy. And then, it's a wild time. It's a wild time. We're kind of living in an impressionist painting where all lines have been diluted, all form is gone, anything goes, and anyone could be whatever they want. It's I guess America really is the land of opportunity. You can, you know, only in this country can you be born a woman and grow up. You only in this country can you be born a man and then grow up to be a female champion. You can be anything you want in America.
Oh, brutal. I was my dad was pretty unhappy with that. He tweeted something out about it and was like, Yeah, people should be unhappy. I don't think things are going to change until like there's something that really, really unpleasant that happens to like somebody in high school. And then their parents go, okay, something needs to change.
You know what?
Unfortunately.
I got to say, this is a women's issue. You know, It's like,
I know
women, but this is like women. Like we don't men, you know, I got enough to worry about. I got to get colon checked. This is for women. Cause like I said, this isn't we don't have that problem where like there's trans men trying to compete with men. And if they did, we would welcome it. Cause that would be amazing if they could do it.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, women got to, it just shows you how divided women are.
Yeah. Strange too, because I feel like, that whole issue was kind of brought forward by women as well. So, like, I think it was brought forward by a lot of people, but I feel like the forefront of bringing it forward were kind of like women wanting this. And now, I don't know, we'll see what happens. I'm going to watch from the sidelines, comment now and then. Hopefully, nobody gets really hurt.
It just shows you how things are finite. The more extreme you go in one direction, you come out the other side. The universe is finite.
Yeah.
There's a finite amount of notes. There's a finite amount of ideas. Because feminism now, if you go all the way to the extreme of feminism, you're basically advocating for a man to go into a female space after he transitions. So you're going like, you've come back to the other side. Like Miss Pac-Man.
Yeah.
That's why extremists have so much in common that they don't acknowledge.
That they just go full circle.
Yeah.
In kind of every aspect, whatever the extreme is. Yeah, that's super weird that happens. That's very true.
Yeah.
You have to be careful. You have to be careful if you're really, I've found that, because I feel like everybody has this problem when they're too attached to one idea. It's like, as soon as you're super, super attached, you're like, oh yeah, I'm 100% certain about this one idea. Then you have to kind of check yourself and say, well, maybe there's something I'm missing because I probably shouldn't be 100% certain about anything.
That's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. Because then you get blind, you become arrogant, and you become blind. That's what happens to powerful people. That's why scientists, the scientific method is the best way, because it's always about amending and
changing.
And so... Yeah. I mean, Socrates nailed that. It's like, you know, always question,
yeah.
You know, always I'm dumb, you know, because you are. I mean, look how big and vast the universe are. We're dumb.
Yes. You're that. Okay. Who are your favorite comics these days?
Well, he's a good friend of mine. But Tim Dillon, I think, is doing something nobody's doing with podcasts for sure. He's off the fly. He's just, he's funny. And he's just so naturally talented and smart. He's fun. Bill Burr is one of my favorites as a stand-up and in anything. Patrice O'Neill was one of my favorites. The late, great Patrice O'Neill was great. But there's so many that are good now. Nate Bargatze's a great, clean comic and just so funny. And there's guys like Dan Soder, Paul Verzi. There's so many funny guys now. But my favorites of all time, George Carlin was a guy I saw. I saw his special, You're All Diseased, in 1999. It was after his wife died. So he was like, you could tell he was like, he put everything. I don't know what he considered his magnum opus, but I consider that to be his best special. He was surly, but not to the point where it wasn't funny anymore. Like towards the end, he got like Bill Hicks towards the end, you're going like, is this comedy or are you just angry? But it had that perfect balance of like bitterness and humor. And it was just, he was just so brilliant, George Carlin, and prolific. So there's a lot. Jackie Gleason was a lot of people don't know about him because he was a long time ago, but he was just gifted. And a lot of people don't know he was a stand-up, and he would go, he'd go into rooms with no material and just rip the room to shreds, and the place would be shaken just because he had so much talent. You know, he used to go into the Honeymooners, which was a failure at the time, which is hilarious. It bombed, and then it became a hit afterwards. But he would go in and he would read the script once. And this was before digital, right? So it was like film was expensive. They shot on film. So like you had to nail the lines. He would read the script once, no rehearsal, and go. And then you can watch the episodes and see what he did. He would memorize it. I mean, the guy was brilliant.
Wow.
Yeah. He would, before He would drink like 100 vodkas. He would eat like 1,000,000 steaks. He was a very big personality. And, you know, even Bob Hope, he was nicknamed the Great One because he was just, the talent was just overwhelming of Jackie Gleason. So.
Okay. I have to check him out. I haven't seen him.
Yeah. He's dead, but.
I saw, yeah, yeah. I saw Bill Burr live once. I think it was in Budapest. And I almost died. He's like, I almost died. I couldn't breathe. He's so ridiculous.
He could be the best. I mean, also Chappelle. And then one that's often overlooked, and I'm not going to say for bad reason because I've seen him so many times live, and it's a crapshoot whether you're going to get a good show or a drunk one. But Doug Stanhope live, when he's on, when everything clicks, because, you know, he's a bit of a drinker. But when he is on, his brain, he's just incredible. So he's definitely up there for me too, Doug Stanhope.
Okay, I'm going to remember that list and have some catching up to do, I think.
If you want to watch Doug Stanhope, it was his Showtime special called No Refunds. It's one of the best specials you'll ever see. And then Patrice O'Neill, Elephant in the Room, which was the one he did like right before he died. That's as good as comedy can get right there.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good. So normally, like when COVID isn't a thing, what do your days look like? Like, how often do you perform? How often do you go out to do comedy shows? Even now, let's say now, because this is the new how we live now. So let's say now.
The pandemic changed things for me because before it was like we'd be out every night doing sets, set after set after set. And then the pandemic hit and we all kind of focused on the internet, or at least the ones who were smart or, you know, were willing to adapt. And now I'm more concerned about my podcast than I am about sets. It's like, I'll go do an hour, like I'll go on the road. And because special doesn't mean what it used to mean. You know, it used to be like you did your sets to get a late night set on a late night television show, or to do a half hour on Comedy Central, or an hour somewhere. But now, like we were talking about before, it's so saturated. There's so many comics, so many specials, so much content. Nobody's watching television anymore. People only watch joke by joke, really. That when I go perform live, I just have more fun. I riff a lot and I don't think about my hour and crafting as much as I used to. And I focus more on my podcast and I put effort into that, researching and thinking about what the joke's going to be on there. Cause you reach more people and then, you know, you build a fan base and then you go perform for your fan base. I mean, the entertainment industry has exploded into 1,000,000 pieces and nobody's really famous anywhere. You're just kind of famous to the people who know you. We're all like touring bands that have fans. And I love it. It's better that way. There are no more Matt Damons.
Yeah, that's very strange. And I guess that's just because anybody can try, right?
Anyone can do it.
You don't have to get a spot on a set or get a position as an actor. You can start creating content and then see if people like it.
Yeah. The gatekeepers have been usurped. They've been rendered unimportant by the internet. It used to be all you wanted to do is get passed at a club. So then you could work at that club. You can work on your act so you can get on late night to get that exposure or get a special. And now you just, you know, I put a video up the other day of Hitler preparing, you know, for his speech in the Mirror. And, you know, 70,000 people saw it or whatever. It's like, I thought of that in 3 seconds because I shaved my mustache like that. So things move quick now. And, you know, comics have to adapt. And a lot of stand-ups haven't, because stand-ups are, especially if you're like my age, like in between the eras, you know, where like it was that era and now it's the internet. A lot of people didn't adapt. And, you know, a lot of people, they don't understand that, you know, survival of the fittest isn't the strongest survive. People always, that's a myth. It's the ones who adapt the best who survive. It's not the strongest. It's the ones best suited for that new environment. And in fact, a lot of times within that species, when a change in the environment happens, the ones who were weak in the previous environment will actually be the ones who adapt best to the new environment, and those previously strong ones die out. So it's all about adapting to the internet now. And the ones who aren't are just going to die off, and they're dying off. And that the that standups have ceded the internet to everybody else because of this stubbornness to stick to what it was. Like, the purity of standup is just naive at best and stupid at more accurate.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think that's even hitting, like, even if you go out of the entertainment industry, even businesses. There were businesses pre-COVID that are like, oh, no, we go by word of mouth, and we have very specific clientele, and they tell their friends about us, and that's how we get clients. And I can remember talking to some people being like, do you have Instagram to advertise so that people can find out about you? It's like, no, we do word of mouth. And then those businesses don't exist anymore because they're like, I don't want to necessarily say arrogant, but like kind of too arrogant to lower themselves to social media.
Yeah. Nailed it. Exactly. I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you have plans for the future other than focusing on the podcast, or is that your main focus at the moment?
I hope there is a future. Yeah.
if there's a future.
Yeah. I think about this stuff too much, but like, I mean, the CCP, they're no joke. They kind of remind me of the early Nazis, and Russia kind of reminds me of the early fascists in Italy. They're kind of like there's a new alignment going on. There's a new, those two allies, the CCP just feels like they're looking to dominate that hemisphere. And
yeah,
what they've done with Taiwan under the cover of COVID, by surreptitiously kind of taking it with that national security law, and what they're doing now with they have this new policy where they're reining in the internet and social media and influencers, and there's this company BGI, which is a Chinese company that was supposedly doing prenatal tests for women, but it was found out they were working with the PLA, the military, and they were actually collecting DNA to manipulate it and try to create, like, this is a Reuters article. This isn't like from, Newsmax. So,
oh man.
Yeah, they were and looking to manipulate pathogens and create like super soldiers. They must have their own manifest destiny the way every empire or rising power does. And we're just so lost in our own bubble. We don't think about them being the new kid on the block and how they want to expand. And because every growing power does. And it's scary. I mean, America's not the only superpower anymore. And we don't have a vulnerable
Definitely
rival
not.
Like Russia was. I mean, China, with that mixed economy, that by any means, necessary economy, reminds me of the Nazi economy, which was very similar. It was like, look, whatever works, markets, socialism, communism, whatever, state controlled, whatever works to make us powerful, military industrial complex, whatever it is, we want to grow. And that's what the CCP is doing. It's a by any means necessary economy to become powerful with a mixture of everything. And now they've arrived. And, COVID was an interesting thing. It was interesting. All those protests were on the street in Hong Kong, their most coveted thing. They want it. They want that one China. All these protests, pro-democracy protests there. And then, boom, COVID hits. Everybody's inside. Then, boom, the national security law is passed, where they surreptitiously take with their allies in Hong Kong, they take Taiwan. And pretty much de facto have taken it. It's overlooked a lot, but they control Taiwan now. And you're going like, either that's a coincidence or that was very opportunistic thinking when COVID hit. But it's just
oh man, I don't know anything about this. I need to learn.
It's very interesting
more
shit.
About this.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah,
shit.
I'm going to just add some extra stress to my life and delve into that. It sounds like you need, this is my plan. I'm going to go to Nashville for the winter, see how that's like. And then I'm going to buy like a nice ranch somewhere, move a whole bunch of people I like there. You're welcome to come if the CCP comes and everything goes to shit. We'll just like have a secret bunker underground just in case. Out far from the cities, we'll just wait. I know how to shoot a gun. I'll be ready.
I mean, that's what people are doing. Everyone's moving to the country. And if this is the new type of warfare, if it's like biological warfare, because you can't set off nukes, mutually assured destruction. We all know that. You bomb us, we bomb you, everything's gone. So maybe this is the new way that war is waged, sort of with manipulated pathogens. And that's scary. That's scary.
Yeah, that doesn't sound fun.
Yeah.
Okay. On that positive note, if people don't follow you, where should they go to follow you and where can they find your podcast?
Yeah, you can watch it on YouTube. It's called Long Days with Yiannis Pappas, and you can get it wherever you get your podcast, Long Days with Yiannis Pappas. And you can watch my special, Blowing the Light, which was produced by Andrew Schultz. That's on YouTube for free. And that's really it. Just go to those two things and follow me on Twitter, Yiannis Pappas. And you'll find me.
Okay. I'll link all those below in the show notes as well.
Thank
if people
you.
Want to check them out. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank
that
you.
That was interesting.
Thanks for
it was nice meeting you.
Nice meeting
I'm
you.
I'm a fan of your comedy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.